As I was riding here this morning, I couldn't help but notice license plate on the back of a late model Nissan 300Z that said Stacy's 300Z, so I'm a little spoiled. And I kind of got the feeling when I was behind that, because my mind was on the crisis in the Middle East, that to some extent a lot of people might die for the sake of Stacy's 300Z and other 300Zs like that. What's your position on that? I mean, is this really just about oil and just about Stacy?
Well, it's more than that. It is true that if we had an energy policy, as President Carter for a long time advocated, but was dropped after we got Presidents Reagan and now President Bush, if we had a really decent energy policy, if we were less dependent on imports of foreign oil, we would not be quite in the bind in which we find ourselves today. But on the other hand, Japan and Germany and other countries would. So that while it is fair to say that this is not certainly not a battle for democracy, because if we restore the King of Kuwait to his throne, we're not restoring a democratic government, nor some of the countries that are allied with us, are they necessarily democratic, as for example now Syria. And it is all confusing, considering how we've spent so many years talking about spreading democracy around the world, that now we're down to trying to save or restore a country which wasn't a democracy anyway, but where the oil flowed. Still, if you say that only, then the question becomes too limited to Stacy and to other Stacys and our profligate ways of using fuels. It is also true that the economy of our country runs on oil. Almost everything in this country is either made with or moved by products that come from the ground. But more than that, there's a question of, are we going to allow somebody to dominate the Middle East, who is in many ways a greater threat to the world as we see it today than the communists ever turned out to be?
Does it give us maybe a moral high ground that we, in this particular issue, that we wouldn't have were it not for Saddam Hussein and his rather brutal behavior in the past? I mean, if he were a different kind of leader who didn't engage in these kinds of things that he did with the Kurds, for example, would our position look different then? Would we look more selfish in this matter?
It certainly is true that Saddam, by playing bad guy, has made it easier to sell America on a need to combat him and possibly to get him out of power there. But it is not only simply a matter of that. Our problem is that we get hung up on our own rhetoric. For all of these years, we had something called the Reagan Doctrine. The doctrine was that wherever there are communists in the world, if there are people called freedom fighters who resist them, we will support these people. That was moral high ground. There was the evil empire called the Soviet Union, and then there was democracy, and we were spreading democracy. Now, of course, we don't have the evil empire called the Soviet Union, or at least not evil anymore, and not really spreading all these doctrines which they themselves are now divesting themselves of anyway. It is very difficult to say we are now in a very, very difficult world where the threats not only to our way of life, but also to our democracy, because our democracy will not last very long if our way of life doesn't last, that those threats do not come from a communist leader, but come from some tin horn dictator who will use poison gas and who will use, if necessary, nuclear weapons if he can develop them, and that he is every bit as dangerous to us, and in fact, as it now appears, much more dangerous to us than these 40 years of Cold War have ever been. So we may have to use different rhetoric for it. It may be difficult to find rhetoric that doesn't go with the Reagan rhetoric of freedom and democracy, but still represents more of the truth. It is not that Saddam is a greater or lesser threat. It is that we've been so carried away by the rhetoric of Cold War that we don't have rhetoric for the war of this kind.
We haven't built it up for that. The last time I talked to you was about changes in Eastern Europe and in the USSR. Of course, now it's the Middle East. Are there any connections between these two? I mean, between what happened last year and before and in Eastern Europe and what's going on now in the Middle East?
I think so. The fact that the Soviet Union and even the countries of Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia, Poland, East Germany, are no longer a factor in the Middle East has clearly made people like Saddam Hussein nervous. Until recently, he was a client of the Soviet Union, which meant that he got a lot of help from them, but they also had some restraining influence on Iraq. Also, they were able to import things they needed from Eastern Europe. The sense that he is now on his own, that that source of supply and that source of support has pretty well disappeared, as well as a source now and then of restraint has all disappeared, has now, I think, made him somewhat more desperate to achieve his goals more quickly than he intended to achieve them, and to achieve them in ways more risky and more drastic than he otherwise might have chosen to achieve them. So yes, I think that in a sense, what is happening in the Middle East is in a sense a function of the vacuum of power between the superpowers created by the fact that the Soviet Union, for all practical purposes, is no longer a superpower in that area.
With respect to the way that the news manages these kinds of events, or maybe they don't manage these kinds of events, maybe the news gets managed by the people who supply information for the news. I'm thinking particularly of reading one day or hearing on the news that the United States military force in the Middle East is quite capable of a quick strike situation, maybe a matter of hours, maybe a matter of days before they could cripple Iraq. And then up comes things like the General Dugin matter, where we begin to talk in a Rambo kind of way, and the following day we begin to hear, now wait a minute, we need to be more cautious. The Iraqis do have a huge force there, and they do have a tremendous amount of military technology that they've gotten from all sources. It seems it's kind of there's some manipulation going on here. Some days we're sort of pumped up with a real pep talk about our military ability, and other days we're told to be cautious. Is this perhaps some kind of strategy?
Oh, I think you're very sensitive and perceptive about seeing the contradictions in American policy. Here are the problem we face in American policy. How do you tell people at the same time that we're going to starve Iraq into submission, but that nobody's going to starve? How do you say that we have the power to, and we'd be willing to, use force against Iraq if necessary, but we're not going to do anything that is not done in concert with the United Nations, with whom we're now working, and our allies? To look both independent and strong at the same time part of a team and working with that team involves you in contradictions. On top of that, there's, in the case of General Dugin, a series of other problems. We have projected now into the Middle East our age-old inter-service rivalry. You got the Navy, you got the Army, and you got the Air Force, always saying that they're going to win the war, and obviously the Air Force traditionally is the one who will come out loudest and strongest and say victory through air power. What General Dugin was doing was not much more than has been done since the 1920s by General Billy Mitchell, which is to say, leave it to us, we can win this war by air power. Now, that is considered to be a nice and generally fine thing to say, except at a sensitive moment which General Dugin couldn't have realized. A moment in which the orchestration of this propaganda is a delicate matter in the hands of the National Security Council and, in fact, of President Bush himself. And so what General Dugin did was to say what he thought was government policy, and in large part was government policy, but he said it too frankly and too directly, and incidentally brought in a couple of things which were really hush-hush and no-no things to say, such as that our B-52s are carrying Israeli missiles, which becomes then propaganda fodder for Hussein, and also that they were discussing with the Israelis the targeting of Saddam Hussein and maybe his mistress in the event of an attack on Baghdad. It is a no-no to talk about Israel right now, which is supposed to be keeping a low profile, but is not considered helpful to the general cause to talk too much about Israel at this point. Well, he violated those rules, tactical rules, general rules. Didn't violate the big rule, which is you always want to say your service is best and that your service can do the job. Nor was he out of step with a policy of trying to scare Saddam Hussein by trying to bring him into terms and with what he faced. And so, General Dugin made the mistake of committing truth.
The propaganda machine isn't supposed to talk about Israel, but you can. What's their role in this? Obviously, there is a very low profile, but they're a major card in the deck in the Middle East.
They're potentially a major card in the deck, but the card right now is sort of being in the hole, so to speak. That's to say that what is recognized is that one of the options of Saddam Hussein, if he really feels terribly pressed, one of his options is to walk through Jordan, which would not be very difficult for him to do, and either menace Israel or start an attack on Israel. Israel has said it will respond if he comes into Jordan in any way that could menace Israel. That might serve a purpose in a way to help to generate support among Arabs, those who are not supporting him, by turning this into a holy war against Israel. And everybody's aware that's one of his options, and nobody wants to help him towards the day when he will do that. In other words, no provocations from Israel. That is why Israel has been asked to, and is generally keeping, very low profile. We hear very little from Israel about how they would mop up Iraq or what they would do in case of attack. And the fact that Israel was consulting with General Dugin on just exactly how he wants to do his targeting was probably not a wise thing for General Dugin to talk about. Israel is there. Israel at some point may be dragged into this, not by Israel's own doing. Israel is fully aware of what the consequences would be, is under enormous pressure, if it were needed, from the Bush administration to walk very quietly, and is walking very quietly. But of course, there is a big stick there.
You said at the beginning that that Iraq, or more specifically Saddam Hussein, is definitely a threat to the United States, and also obviously now a threat to some of his brothers in the Middle East. Does the resolution of this situation ultimately have to mean that Iraq will have to be reduced militarily and Saddam Hussein will have to go? I mean, are we just taking baby steps in that direction?
Well, at least we're taking talking steps in that direction. In his most recent speech on the subject to a joint session of Congress, President Bush said that the fact that Iraq has been building up nuclear and chemical weapons and a missile capacity represents a threat which we must do something about. Now, unless this is, read my lips, no new taxes, simply a statement which at the proper time you're going to ignore again, this represents a commitment. Clearly, let us say if the best of all things happen at the moment, which at last word seems less likely than ever, that is to say that Saddam Hussein agreed to get out of Kuwait, which is our only stated war aim at this point, mm-hmm. is that we restore the status quo ante, that he get out and go back to Iraq. We have no other specific stated war aim. But clearly, it is not possible to say that all he has to do is, having looted Kuwait and almost reduced that country to a wreck, that he goes back to Iraq, continues developing all those weapons, and comes out again some other day when he's ready again. What would that all be for? So that the United States and our allies are wrestling with the question of what happens in case we do get Kuwait back, in case we do win a victory, either by pressure of embargo or by other means, what then? And the answer, which is not stated, has to be obvious. It will not be possible to let Iraq go back to its position of being a potential threat to the Middle East and to the world, and so you have to assume that not only that Saddam Hussein has to go, but that something is going to be done about demolishing the war-making capacity of Iraq.
So if he does go back, we might have to be rented longer by the sheikhs and emirs to stay in the Middle East, because he remains a threat and obviously would build up probably even to be a larger threat. I mean, it seems a curious situation that if the stated aim, as you say, that we have to get him out of Kuwait is satisfied and he does return home, that we're almost stuck there because he continues to be to loom as a threat with the enormous military power that he has. The other option seems to be that we really have to take outright military action and somehow reduce his forces and reduce his war capacity.
Well, Jim, in the same speech that where President Bush said that he was hoping to see American forces in Saudi Arabia home soon, he said, in the next sentence he went on to say that America would be a permanent presence in the Middle East and in the Gulf area. It seemed to me then that there was a certain contradiction between saying we're taking our troops home but we're going to stay there, which means only that we will not stay there in the same force that we're there. We'll stay there perhaps in a different kind of format. There's some talk about having some NATO-like security organization there where we'll be there with other powers. But I think it is taken for granted, and it's more or less suggested quite openly by President Bush, that simply winning this current war is not the end of it. We are now committed with others to being a part of that scene for a very, very long time to come. There's been a destabilization of that area, and things will not go back to the rather tenuous stability that they had before, will not go back for a long time. A lot of chips have been thrown into the air and landed now down in quite different places. The Middle East is a different area than it was, and America is now committed, in a way, having just disengaged ourselves from many years of Cold War with the Soviet Union. The post-Cold War era means that we get heavily engaged in other parts of the world, and this is the first of them.
Some people really think that that's the ultimate agenda on this thing, that we want to establish ourselves there permanently. That's where the major amount of oil is. That's power in the future. Should we give much credence to that notion that this is the way that we are getting ourselves in there, and that Saddam Hussein has provided us the opportunity that we might have been looking for?
I accept that, except for the word opportunity. I don't think it was all as cynical as saying, hey, here's a big chance for us to go into there. No, I think it's very painful to the United States, which is basically an isolationist country. Basically, in spite of the fact that we've been involved in two world wars, into each of which we were dragged, in spite of the fact that we've been involved with Europe and helping to defend Europe against a Soviet threat for 40 years, in spite of all of that, the fact of the matter is the United States historically feels it has enough to do at home and doesn't like to be mixed up in other parts of the world. Alas, the world is too much with us. Alas, we cannot depend, as we almost could once, entirely on our own resources. There was a time we could really let the world go pass us by, because almost everything we needed we had. Oh, we had to get manganese from somewhere. We had at some point, to get ore for our atomic plants. So there are certain things which we are not self-sufficient in. But as much as a country can be self-sufficient, we were, or considered ourselves once. And now we aren't. And now, perhaps because we have not gone to alternate sources of energy, or perhaps because we have been too profligate with the energy from fossil fuels that we do use, we are dependent. And as long as we are dependent, neither President Bush nor, I imagine, any administration will ever again be able to say, let the world pass by. We're going to have to be in that world and helping to run that world. The only thing that's different today is we're not doing it against the Soviets and their theoretical threat, but in fact will be doing it in concert with the Soviets. Well, that's the new part of the world, is we and the Soviets against all comers.
Part of what is going on there is the West, Western ideals, Western mores, Western practices in the Middle East. Not for all of the Middle East, but certainly for parts of it. Does this mean that if we're going to be involved in that part of the world, that the Islamic fundamentalist kinds of concerns of Western ideas turning their traditional society topsy-turvy, that they're coming to the end of that, or is that going to be a continual struggle?
Well, I think culture is a very important issue. I'm not sure to what extent religion is in the way we thought it would be after the Khomeini Shiite fundamentalist revolution in Iran. It is true that 10 years ago we thought that was the coming wave of the future, and that the infection of that kind of fanaticism would sweep, as it did, into Lebanon, and appeared to be almost going to sweep over Iraq, and they had their aim of reaching Jerusalem and all of that. And for a long time, that was what we feared. And in fact, that was why, for many years, the United States tilted towards Iraq as a kind of a buffer against Iran. But Iran was defeated. And the Iranian style of fundamentalism does not appear to be marching on at this point, and appears maybe to have suffered severe setbacks. And while Saddam Hussein has lately begun to talk the language of Islam, the fact of the matter is that for many, many years he was much better known as a secular radical and not very religious, and in fact came to power in Iraq on a program that was in opposition to religious group. His party, the Ba'ath Party, was a secular radical group. So that is not religion so much we have to contend with. What we have to contend with is a struggle between secular radicalism and Islamic fundamentalism in the Middle East, and the ways in which those fights and many other struggles for power, the pan-Arab idea, of having one Arab nation. Saddam thinks should be under him, which is only a revival of of Nasserism in Egypt, when he thought years ago that there should be Egypt and Nasser should lead pan-Arab movements. All of those things mean we have to understand better the forces which are loose in the Middle East, which are not as simple as just religious forces, understand them better, cope with them, choose our friends, I hope more wisely than the United States has chosen friends before. You know, at one point they were tilting heavily towards Iraq. At the same time, President Reagan started tilting towards Iran, looking for moderates there. And now, I don't know if we've started tilting towards Syria. We have to sort of stop tilting.
If you could write a happy ending, maybe there isn't a happy ending to this kind of a situation, but what would be the best way this crisis could be resolved? Maybe there isn't a best way.
Jim, if I could write a happy ending, I wouldn't be a journalist. Well, obviously the happiest ending, the best case scenario, is that Saddam Hussein is overthrown by an internal revolt of more sensible people than he, and decide that he's going to ruin that country. And no one will ever believe that we didn't do it, but if it is done as a result of what happened inside Iraq, and if that then is not followed by another version of Saddam Hussein, another dictator, but if somewhere we see some sign of a demand for democracy and a pluralism in Iraq in the beginning, the kind of thing which swept across Eastern Europe and many other countries. That is the best case scenario. So good a case that I wouldn't bet heavily on it.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
Sure.
KPBS's Jim Clapp speaking with National Public Radio senior news analyst Daniel Shore.